Welcome to LSE Limelight from Viva Sound, where we unfold the best stories from students around LSE. With me, Yasmina O'Sullivan. Today, we're discussing LSE in a new decade with LSE Director Minouche Shafiq. A quick note to listeners. Twice at the end of the podcast, I mistakenly say overstaffed instead of understaffed, with reference to LSE cleaners. This week on LSE Limelight, we are discussing LSE in a new decade, and we're really lucky to be joined by LSE Director Minouche Shafiq. And we realise it's March, but it is still worth reflecting on where we've been and where we're going. So thank you so much for joining us, Minouche.
My pleasure. Really good to be here.
Brilliant. So let's start by focusing on LSE Shape the World 2030 and how we can ground this in current events at LSE to make it a little bit more tangible and connect to it more. It's structured around three priorities. Could you share these three priorities of LSE Shape the World 2030 with us?
So there are three pillars to the strategy. The first pillar is educating for impact and really seeing our students as leaders and change makers who will have an impact on the world. The second pillar is research for the world and really putting a focus on the fact that the ideas that come out of the LSE have an impact everywhere and how can we do that even more effectively. And then the third pillar is LSE for everyone. The idea of building LSE as a community that includes both students, staff, faculty, and also being open to the community both locally and also globally.
Brilliant. So let's start with priority one, chronological order. And let's take the example of LSE's commitment to climate change. One of the sub-commitments of this priority one, educate for impact, is to educate for 2030 and beyond. So let's consider what 2030 will look like. By 2030, even if we keep to 1.5 degrees Celsius average global temperature increase, scientists estimate that we'll be facing increased frequency and extremity of floods, storms, and other natural disasters, which will likely cause a growth in the number of climate refugees we're presently observing. The politics and economics of 2030 will be affected by this change. What is LSE doing to prepare students for this reality?
So a lot of the work to understand the economic, political and social impact of climate change has actually been done at the LSE. The Grantham Institute is at the forefront of understanding the economic risks of climate change. Many other departments in the school, ranging from geography to sociology to law, are looking at different aspects of what climate change is doing to the world. And so I think the school has done a great job of putting this on the agenda and analysing it. I think, though, we face some real challenges now about what we are doing about it. And that's why I've asked Nick Stern to lead a sustainability advisory group that includes students, faculty, staff from across the school to ask what we should do. And that group has just launched a consultation, which I'm very keen to have as many people engage in. That consultation is a very short questionnaire which asks the views of the LSE community, what should the school be doing? And we're taking a comprehensive approach. And so we're looking at education. What should the curriculum look like at the LSE to equip our students to be able to live in a more sustainable world and influence policy on sustainability? What research topics should we be prioritizing? What should we do in terms of our own operations in the school? How do we, in terms of our own energy consumption, our own food consumption, our suppliers? And then also, what about our own investments? We don't have a huge endowment, but we do need to be socially responsible in the endowment that we have and our own investments.
It's very interesting that you touched on curriculum and education. A kind of vocabulary and term which is being thrown around now is climate education. Obviously, as an educational institute, there is a responsibility to prepare students for that world to come. Would you agree that to not provide an education which prepares in climate change and, say, a climate education would be a failure by an institution to prepare their students for the reality of 2030?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is definitely what we think. The question is, how should we do it? And so the questionnaire actually asks everyone in the LSE community, how should we prepare the next generation to think about sustainability in their education? Should we have a mandatory course for everyone? Should we embed it across the curriculum in different ways? Should we have modules in different programs? Should we have additional classes that people can take? So we definitely want to do something. The only question is how, and we want to make sure that we make that decision in a consultative way.
And in your opinion, would that education need to be provided for everyone? We see currently in qualitative degrees the discussion of a more inclusive education. So thinkers who are women, thinkers who are non-Western, thinkers who are more diverse, and potentially climate change can come into that discussion. But what about quantitative students, often being forgotten about because we have these two sides of the university? Would you commit to providing climate change-related education for everyone, regardless of their type of degree?
I think, again, the only question is how and what would be most appropriate. One possibility, for example, is to use the vehicle of LSE 100, which is mandatory for everyone, and having a sustainability component in that. But some people would argue, actually, we need to embed it in every degree. So if you're studying finance, actually, there's a lot of issues you should be thinking about in terms of sustainable investing. What, you know, how do you define a green investment? What does that mean? What does a green portfolio look like? Should banks be financing certain types of energy supplies or not, et cetera, et cetera? So what I want to hear from people in LSE is, which do you think is the more powerful approach? Some people will argue that embedding it in throughout the curriculum is actually a more profound way of doing it. Other people will say, actually, we need to make sure that everybody gets the same core of knowledge when they leave the LSE on the impact of climate change. And so, again, as I said, we will do something. What it is will depend on what the LSE community thinks will be most effective.
Interesting. So, with this topic, student activism is a major issue and has been really active around LSE. I wonder if you could share with us how student activism during your time here has challenged you directly.
Well, certainly, you know, I do town halls pretty regularly, and in recent town halls, climate change has come up as the most important topic that we get questions on. We've had other issues throughout the year around, since my time here, ranging from issues around controversial speakers, the Globe, as well as issues around, you know, conflicts going on in the world that spill over. I always say to everyone, you know, everything that's happening in the world happens at the LSE. Everything spills over and manifests itself here because we are a reflection of everything going on in the world, given that we have such an international student body.
A final question on this topic, touching on climate change, and slightly broader than LSE alone. You're obviously an expert in international economic policy. I wonder if you could share your personal view on what is needed in order to tackle climate change globally.
I mean, the most efficient way as an economist to tackle it would be to have a global carbon tax. And that would be the most powerful mechanism to change the incentives of everyone in the world in how they use carbon. I think the likelihood of that happening anytime soon is low. But, you know, if you ask me what the optimal thing to do is, that would be the optimal thing. But I think there are a lot of other things one can do in the absence of that. Many countries are now implementing national level carbon taxes and finding a way to make it fiscally neutral. So you change the incentives that people face, but you don't increase their tax burden. I think that's quite a clever policy. There's huge pressure now on corporations, and coming from citizens, from shareholders, from the financial sector, and from consumers to change their behavior. That too is incredibly important. The other thing is there is a huge opportunity in terms of green investments. We're in a moment in history when investment is too low in most parts of the world. And we have an opportunity to change that by providing incentives, both public and private sectors, to invest in the technologies of the future. And I think that would be good for the climate, but also good for the economy.
Moving now on to the second priority, research for the world. I'd like to ground this in the example of funding and academic freedom at LSE. So researching for the world, of course, still means maintaining a core commitment to academic freedom and rigorous standards of research output at LSE. But LSE has previously been hit by funding scandals, notably a donation from Saif Gaddafi, and recently the FT reported about Huawei's offering a donation to fund a three-year project to study the technology company's leadership in developing 5G technology. We'll get onto the Huawei topic in a moment, but first, could you share with us the process that LSE takes in deciding whether to accept funding?
So there are lots of misconceptions about how this process works, so I very much welcome the opportunity to clarify it. First of all, academic freedom is at the core of everything we do. And it is a hugely important value for the school, and we have a policy on it, and it's part of our ethics code and so on. And so it really is at the core. The school has put in place very rigorous processes to review external funding. We have a committee that has 19 senior professors on it who review donations and grants to the school. There is nobody on that committee who solicits grants, so nobody from our team that does fundraising, nobody, I'm not on it, any of my peers on the school management committee who might be involved in trying to encourage donations to the school are not involved in this committee. So it is independent academics who are there to judge the validity of the donation, whether it adds to the academic life of the school, and whether it's consistent with our ethical and reputational guidelines. We turn down many donations because we're not comfortable with either the topic or the donor or some combination thereof. So we are not in the business of soliciting donations from anywhere, and we're actually, partly because of the history, quite self-critical about where and when we accept funds. And as a second check, if that committee is uncertain, they can also refer it to advice from the school management committee. And we also, so there are many ways in which this is reviewed. I think we do a pretty good job of assessing where funding comes from. And I should also add that every single donation we accept has in the gift agreement a commitment to academic freedom, and that donor cannot intervene in the topics of the research, the conclusions of the research, how it's published, and academic freedom is guaranteed as part of every gift agreement.
You mentioned before we did this interview that you wanted to clarify some things about the FT article about Huawei. Would you like to?
Yes, so that was not a donation. That was a piece of research that was requested from a faculty member at the school who is an academic who does research on the management of technology, and he was asked to provide research on a particular topic. It was not a donation to the school.
Then can we talk in a theoretical sense then about potential donations from a company such as Huawei? Oxford University last year chose to stop accepting funding from Huawei in future and to stop its current funding with them. Should Huawei tomorrow come to LSE and offer a large donation, would you accept it?
Well, it's very hard to respond to a hypothetical. I think it would, I guess what I would say is that any donor who came to the school, we would look at their own reputation. We would look at whether it had academic merit, and we would look at guarantees around academic freedom. There are a lot of interesting research questions around 5G. It will transform many economies in the world. I very much hope that there is a lot of research going on about the impact of 5G on our world. And, you know, I think we would have to look at and in each case on its merits. And as I said, the protection of academic freedom is at the core of every single gift agreement we have done. And academics themselves have to be free to do research on topics that they think are important and valid. And it's not for either the school or other academics to constrain their ability to ask research questions that are valid.
So we previously mentioned student action. Now, staff action has played a role in this topic in particular. For example, last year, the China programme, funded by Eric Lee, was put on hold due to, in part, staff action in writing letters and pushing the institution not to accept this funding. I ask now, if the Ethics Committee procedures are so rigorous, why are academics having to fight for you not to accept certain donations?
Well, that also is a slight, let me provide clarity on the sequence of events. What actually happened was that Eric Lee was in very preliminary conversations about funding a China program at the LSE. Immediately that was taken to consult with faculty who worked on China. There were many faculty involved in those consultations. And as a result of that consultation, a decision was taken that there wasn't enough of a consensus as to what that could look like to proceed. It was only after that consultation and that decision was taken that some people chose to talk to the Financial Times.
Very interesting. On that point, we're talking about China and we're talking about funding, which is connected or related to the regime. I'd like to talk about what it means to accept funding from an organisation which might be connected or tied to. So China has an authoritarian regime. It disappears dissidents, curtails academic freedom, and at present detains Uyghur Muslims for re-education. Does accepting funding from an organisation, be that Huawei, be that Eric Lee, in a theoretical situation, does that, which is so close to the political regime, does that inadvertently legitimise the regime's practices?
I think the question is, the question is who you're taking the money from, and there are processes in place to review that, and I've already described what those are, and we have similar processes in place for accepting money from governments, on which we have a very high bar. I think it would be a huge pity if the LSC faculty and students didn't do research on China. It's a hugely important country. It will be a hugely part of everyone's future. Issues like climate change will not be solved without China engaging in that issue. We also have many faculty who are Chinese and many students who are Chinese. And they're an important part of the LSE community.
But in this case, we're not discussing researching China or engaging with students, but accepting donations,
right,
from or money from an organisation or person who might be connected to the regime,
right,
is really where we're going.
And in all of those cases, we would go through our process and we would have a committee of 19 very senior faculty across the school who would have to look at each one of those cases and judge the value of that contribution.
Brilliant. I'd now like to touch on something which is quite relevant to right now. We are in the week of LSE Festival, which is running from the 2nd to the 7th of March. And you mentioned that this is the third in
yes,
the series of LSE festivals, which is an annual occurrence, which is tied into this second priority, being research for the world. Can you share with us, this podcast will actually be released after the festival is over, sadly, but can you share with us why you think this festival is important, what you are looking forward to or actually reflecting on, and just a little bit about the festival?
So the idea of the festival was that we would have an occasion once a year when everyone in the LSE could participate in an event which was on a globally important topic. So the first one was about beverage 2.0 and reform of the welfare state. The second one was about global disorder. And this one is around shape the world and how the social sciences can shape the world. And so it was partly motivated by a desire to build a sense of an intellectual community in the school, but it's also public facing. And at a time when expertise and ideas and rigorous debate isn't happening enough in the world, we want the LSE to be a place where that happens. And it is extraordinary how the events are so well attended and people from all walks of life come both physically to the school, but also listen to the podcasts and online to these debates. And I think it's both a public service that the school provides to the world, but also a hugely important way to build community for everyone at LSE.
Fantastic. I'd now like us to move to our third segment, which is the third priority of Shape the World 2030 strategy. This is develop LSE for everyone. Mm. And I'd like to ground this in the example of the experiences of LSE cleaners and the Beaver's recent reporting. So I'd like to share just two quotes from the strategy, the first being this. We nurture a vibrant, open and inclusive environment where individuals from diverse backgrounds are able to share a sense of belonging, purpose and opportunity. The second quote, invest in developing all our staff. Focus on staff voice, community and well-being. Now, would you agree that this should apply to all staff, from cleaners to directors?
Yes.
Brilliant. Easy question. Easy question. That's very good. The Beaver's recent reporting on the experience of cleaners revealed a broad-based feeling of being overworked and under pressure by managers at LSE. At night, 7 cleaners are expected to deep clean 14 floors of the centre building. This is a building with a large number of classrooms, whiteboards, bathrooms on each floor and more. You've got to quantify. Do you think this task is realistic for this number of people while maintaining healthy well-being?
Well, I mean, first of all, the LSE was one of the first universities to bring cleaners onto the staff of the LSE, and we were leaders in that. The cleaners at the LSE get full benefits, including pensions, sick, and holiday pay. We have compared our terms to our peers around London, and they are among the best. Now, I do not monitor the work in the centre building. As you can imagine, there are people who manage that work, and I'm sure they think a lot about workload and how that should be managed. And if there are individual cases where people have any issues, they can take that up with their managers or through the myriad of ways that people have if they are not happy with their working conditions. But I think portraying a move that the school took in which it exercised considerable leadership in the sector of bringing hundreds and hundreds of cleaning staff onto the payroll and to being a responsible employer as something that was a mistake, I think, is misguided.
Mm, right. I think the point which is being raised here with the piece is broadly a message of understaffing and overpressure. So not so much on the angle of, and I agree, LSE leading in practice in this case. So we're hearing a story of overstaffing and under pressure from one side here, from the ground, from the Beaver's perspective. And that being difficult for the cleaners to work in this environment. But we're hearing a different story from LSE spokespeople, from one could say the top. So I'd like to ask, how confident are you in the middle management? Because the story we are hearing is from difficulty in the middle management. Is this something that LSE needs to have a think about?
Well, I think there are norms in terms of workload, and I think I would like to think that our middle management are aware of what normal expectations are for certain roles, and you know, I have no reason to believe that that is not being adhered to. If individuals have problems, they should speak to their managers or they should speak to HR. There are pre-existing mechanisms where people can provide feedback if they have concerns about their roles. I think that's the proper way of dealing with these issues rather than insinuations and allegations told to.
Of course, I totally agree. I think the issue here, however, is absolutely those mechanisms are in place. But the story we're hearing, and it's actually validated from another point I'd like to bring in a moment, that there is a sense of being unable to use those mechanisms due to a pressure, due to overstaffing, to keep quiet and to go about work and keep pushing yourselves. We've heard from people suspected of being sources for the Beaver's reporting that they've been questioned by LSE staff, asking why they spoke to the Beaver. What do you think of this?
Well, there are many channels through which people can raise concerns which are independent and confidential. So they should be used. That is the appropriate way of dealing with these issues, not by, you know, rumors and gossip. There are proper channels, there are proper investigations done, and that's how you deal with these issues.
That kind of concludes our three sections of the three priorities. Before we tie things off, let's quickly mention the fact that this week, when the podcast is being recorded, is London Wellbeing Week. Would you like to share some thoughts on that?
Well, the school is making a huge investment in promoting wellbeing, and we will actually very shortly be launching a framework for thinking about wellbeing in the school. We have put a lot more resources into the counselling service, but I think that is really a very small part of the solution. We also realise that it's important to look at the way the academic experience works at the LSE, how assessment works, how preventative measures might be able to support wellbeing, so we don't try and solve the problem at the end when the kind of symptoms of show up of mental health issues, but rather try and preempt them earlier on. So we will be launching a framework that really looks from end to end about how we can support students when they come, how we can support them throughout, and how we can make sure that the academic support and the experience that they have at the school helps to support well-being rather than exacerbate it.
Wonderful. And in tying this up, let's think about your own experience. This is the third year of your leadership at LSE. I was wondering if you could share with us a moment that you have cherished in the last 3 years.
Well, it's hard for me to pick one moment, but I can point to a pattern, which is I really cherish the fact that people at LSE are increasingly confident about their ability to improve things. And so a whole series of things, ranging from delivering resits for the first time in the school's history, or the opening of the centre building and how that has become a kind of community focus for so many people at the school, to when I travel and meet alumni everywhere around the world and see how successful they are in their lives. This sense of things getting better and that the school having the confidence that we can make things better. I think that feeling is what I really enjoy the most.
Fantastic. A final question that I ask all interviewees on LSE Limelight is, if listeners only went away with one thought, what would you want that to be?
Well, I think, you know, for me, everywhere I go in the world, I hear people say, we need better leaders and we need new ideas. And the LSE is a place that fosters leadership and ideas. And I think everyone at this school, at every level, be it, you know, from the most junior member of staff or the young, you know, the incoming first year students to those who, the most senior faculty, have a role to play in fostering better leadership and new ideas. And if that happened across the school at every level, it would be truly transformative and shape the world.
Thank you very much for being us, Director Shafiq.
Very good, thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. The interviewee was LSE Director Minouche Shafiq, and we were discussing LSE in a new decade. The wonderful music is by Ashley Lyo Marsing. I have been your host, Yasmina O'Sullivan. Subscribe to The Beaver Sound on Spotify.